So, right, today was my turn to kind of review what we saw on the last lecture. So, here we go. Okay, so the first thing we saw was the actions for gravity. So, we saw that we can write the regular action for gravity we always write down is this one. This is the Riemann scalar, where we can write it both in three or four dimensions. And the difference, the main difference we have here is that, for example, for the vacuum equations, we know that this implies that R mu nu, the Ricci tensor, is zero. But in three dimensions, this has further implications because if you count the degrees of freedom for the Riemann scale, for the Riemann tensor and the Ricci tensor, they both have 6 degrees of freedom. So if R mu nu is zero, then the Riemann tensor is also zero. So this means, particularly, that gravity is a topological theory in 3D, which to me, I kind of see there's no space-time dynamics in vacuum for vacuum solutions, right? Because I mean, if I have a right-hand side of that equation, this wouldn't be true, right?
Right. You're within the physical, your physical phase space is kind of trivial.
Okay. Yes. So topological theory. Okay. So then we went to study a little bit of the first-order formalism in 3D gravity, for which we introduced the triad, which has both space-time indices and spin indices. So we saw that we can write the metric in this fashion. And first, we noticed that our fundamental object, in this case, which is a triad, has 9 degrees of freedom in contrast to the metric that has 6. So we have an additional SO3 symmetry that we can see that if we, this is the how we transform basically, we see that the action, the not the action, the sorry, the metric remains invariant when we do this transformation. So then we went into studying the spin connections. That to me, I saw it as a way to expand the covariant derivative into also taking account these internal indices. And the extension is quite natural. It's like extending your covariant derivative as to act as it does with the Christoffel symbols or whatever connection you have there with this spin connection acting on the spin indices on this way. So if you want to, I don't know if you guys can see this, if as we have a compatibility condition with the metric. We also have it for the triad. So this would be just putting this guy, the triad, on this equation. We see that gives us this little equation here. We can rearrange to have a definition of this Christoffel symbol or whatever we want it to be in this fashion. So if we actually want it to be the Christoffel symbol, then it has to be metric compatible. And it has to be torsion-free. So what we saw is that to be metric compatible, we have to have that the spin connection has to be anti-symmetric in its indices. And then when we wrote down the torsion-free condition, this wasn't zero a priori. But I guess we can make it zero somehow, right? I think that's where we stopped yesterday. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Some questions.
No. Yes.
So I don't fully understand what's the physical meaning of that compatibility.
Compatibility condition.
Condition.
Yeah. I think it's like when you say that you want your covariant derivative to do the same thing to your metric. I think you can think it as something like that, maybe. I mean, you always ask your covariant derivative to kill your metric, right? This is something that you usually do, right? When you want the Christoffel symbols and all of that. So it's kind of like an analog, maybe?
So you mean that you assume that and you can obtain.
I don't know if you're assuming that, but I don't really know.
You want me to?
Yes, sure.
So intuitively, I think.
I need the microphone.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
I forgot I was wearing this.
Thank you.
So does that mean that the parallel transport in my curved space is compatible with parallel transport in the local inertial frame. Yeah.
And in fact, so here we choose to have this compatibility condition. So there are two. Wait, first, you know that. So let's go back to maybe just the usual covariant derivative with the Levi-Civita connection. You know that the Levi-Civita connection is totally and uniquely determined by the fact that you require that this connection is metric compatible. Okay, so because of that, this means that your connection, the Levi-Civita connection, can be written exactly in terms of your metrics. Okay, but this is not. I mean, this is when you consider a metric connection. You can work in different settings where you have more general connections and you don't require, and then there are independent variables. Okay, in GR it's not the case. We work with specific connection, which is a metric connection. And here what we wanted, so we need now a new connection because we have this new object. So we need to be able to relate neighborhood object living on this internal at the level of the internal space. So we need to introduce a new covariant derivative. And here we require this condition because in fact if you require that, so there are two aspects to this condition. First, with this condition then we've shown that our spin connection can be written explicitly in terms of the Levi-Civita connection and the triad. Okay, so it's totally determined. But the interest also of having this condition here is that, so now how are you going to use this object? You're going to use this object by, if now you have a space-time object, you can contract this space-time object with triad or co-triad to make it living in your internal space, okay? And what you want is that if you take the covariant derivative of that object, you want that it's the same thing as if you were taking the covariant derivative of your space-time object and then contracted with this thing. So this, what is this compatibility condition doing is that now the contraction is commuting with this derivative, okay, with this new derivative. So this means that you can really, there is no order. You can really work with at the space-time level or on the internal space level and act with your covariant derivative and everything is, and we're going to see that when we're going to write right now. So right now, what is the idea? What we want to do is really to, so this is the starting point. This is our action. So now we're going to focus on the 3D case. And we want to rewrite this as a function. So here it's a functional of your metric or your inverse metric. And now we want this action to be a functional of our triad and spin connection, okay? And so we're going to see that the first step is, of course, to write the Riemann tensor as a function of E and omega, okay, the spin connection. And we're going to see that here we're going to use indeed that we can go from this covariant derivative, the new one, which is to this one when we are just talking about space-time indices, okay? Just maybe one point that here was maybe not totally clear. So here you don't have an equality sign, okay? It's just that this is equal to 0, in this case, imply that this one is also equal to 0. And this is because, so we haven't computed that explicitly, but in 3D, this Riemann tensor can be written as a linear combination of this. Okay, so when this is equal to 0, since this is a linear combination of this object, then you get that this is 0. And indeed, we just did this counting of degrees of freedom to see that, indeed, we were not missing anything here, okay? But you don't really have like these are equal. It's
I was equating the zeros.
Okay. Okay.
When they are zero, I can't do it.
Yeah, zero equals zero. Yeah, you're right. That this is this is a good equality. Okay, perfect. okay, so now, as I said, the first step is to really write the first order action for gravity. Right now, we have the objects we need to write it in terms of these new variables, and then we're going to at least go to the canonical analysis. First, even before that, we can, once we have this object, it's going to be easy to see what are the symmetry of our action. And then doing the canonical analysis, what is going to be important is, of course, we're going to get constraint as we expect that. But it's going to be to relate the constraint to the symmetry, okay? Because in fact, we're going to see that going to the quantum level, we're really going to use the fact that we have a kind of geometrical understanding of this constraint to implement them at the quantum level, okay? Because even if, contrary to the metric formalism where we don't know at all how to quantize the constraint. Here, the constraints are still complicated objects, so the way we constrain them is really by having a good understanding of their kind of geometrical interpretation. Okay, so the first step we need to do is to really to write the action in terms of the spin connection and the triad, is to determine the expression of the curvature. So maybe I should keep this ball and go here in terms of the spin connection. And okay. Oh, and just before, just something also I wanted to clarify. Mm-hmm. So here, yeah, the point is then what I did at the end of the lecture yesterday was to define a connection using this expression that we get from this compatibility connection without making any assumption of this connection, and then see what if we impose now that it's metric compatible and torsion free, what do we get on omega and vice versa, okay, to get what are the relation. So just my point is that what we found is that indeed we want that omega, the spin connection, is going to be antisymmetric. And if we impose also the torsion free of gamma, the Levi-Civita connection, we also get that omega is torsion free. But what we're going to do when we're going to write work in the action, right now, I'm just going to assume that omega is antisymmetric. So this means that we leave some freedom for the torsion. And in fact, it's true that this Cartan formalism is Cartan geometry is more general than just Riemann geometry because you allow this torsion to have here. Okay, and here we're working more in the framework of Cartan geometry instead of Riemann geometry. But we're going to see also as soon as we have the action and we look at the equation of motion that it's going to come as an equation of motion. So here, I want to write this object, so the Riemann tensor. So let me try to keep as a function of this antisymmetric spin connection. And so here, I'm going to use that the curvature tensor can be written in terms of the covariant derivative. And do you remember what is the interpretation, how we write this object in terms of a covariant derivative? What is this curvature tensor describing? Yeah, okay, so it describes just non-commutativity of this covariant derivative. So here we can really write that this is something like so that I don't get missed. Start. Okay, so here I'm just acting on a object with only space-time index, okay, one form. So I don't need, I'm just using the usual covariant derivative. And this is here's an issue of indices, sequence. No?
Right.
So here, I guess I want this, and then, okay. Okay, and so now I'm going to transform this object in terms of my co-triad in terms of an object. So here, I can rewrite this, and this I let you to check that indeed this is okay, too. So now I'm using the new covariant derivative in terms of the spin connection because indeed now this object is one form for the is a covector for the internal index. Okay. And I can now use my expression of this covariant derivative. So yesterday I gave you that on this object, so I can write it explicitly. So of course you have to be careful because it's a product of two and it's not commuting. And so what you're going to get is the object you're going to get here is indeed what we're going to call the curvature two form associated to the spin connection. And I'm just going to write the right indices here, and then okay. V. Okay, so first, what is this object? This object is the curvature 2 form of the connection omega. And explicitly, we can write it like this. And this just comes from really expanding this derivative in terms of is anti-symmetric in mu. Mu J L mu L mu K minus exchanging again mu and nu. Mu K. Okay, so this is subject, and it's exactly so now you have this correspondence that this object is equal to this new curvature 2 form for the spin connection multiplied by these two triad or the triad and the cotriad. Okay, so now because we're working in 3D, that we can do something. As I said, we want to work anyway with anti-symmetric spin connection here, and in 3D we can really impose that. And what is nice also is that by imposing that, we also make that these objects are kind of related to SO3 or SU2, the SU2 algebra. So it's going to be really convenient. So let me introduce this. So we can really, so this is really specific to 3D. Okay. We can enforce the anti-symmetry. And also, this object is also anti-symmetric in J and K. And of by defining mu jk is epsilon jlk and mu. And so here mu jk epsilon jlk F mu nu L. And in fact, in all the literature, you're always going to work with now this object, okay? Or this object. Everything is, so you only have your, we started with object with two indices in the internal space, and now we're going to work with this object with one index, and you will have some of this. So this is a totally anti-symmetric tensor. That has, of course, epsilon 1, 2, 3 is equal to 1. But more importantly, these are also the constant structure of SU2 or SO3, the algebra. Okay, so. And so we're going to see that this play a role here. So let me just rewrite explicitly what are all these objects we're going to work with. And then I can write explicitly what is the action. So
Now, let me just rewrite what is the covariant derivative, the curvature form. So now it's just a form. And the torsion form. So that we're going to use, and we're going to get that as in the equation of motion also. So it's good that. So now, if I rewrite using this form instead of. So I obtain something like this. So J, K. Okay. This is for the covariant derivative. Now, the curvature form is really just so here it's anti-symmetric, and here the anti-symmetry is again obtained with this through this epsilon ij mu j nu k, and we will need the so this is the torsion. So this is the curvature. Form is the torsion. And something similar, but now it's for the E, the triad. Okay, the co-triad here. Mu L. K, mu j mu k minus something similar. I'm not sure. I don't think we need this. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I will have to check, I guess. This is correct. So we want that this is antisymmetric in these two indices. This should be fine. OK, so these are the important objects we will need. And we see that these two forms are going to appear in the equation of motion, OK, when we rewrite. So now, the step we want to rewrite the Einstein Hilbert action in terms of this new variable. And we're almost there, okay? Because, of course, we started from, so, starting point. And here, yeah, this is just mu nu, g mu nu. And in terms of the Riemann, sorry, as a term of the Riemann tensor, so we can just use, so we know how to express J in terms of the triad. We know how to express the Riemann tensor in terms of the triad and connection. And so this is just the determinant of the metric, and it's going to be related, of course, to the determinant of the triad. Okay. So here, what we get, I'm not going to give you all the steps. So you have more detail in the lecture note that I still need to upload on the wiki page, but I will do that tonight. And so now what we get is, using everything we know, so the determinant of G, I can give you, is related, since G is kind of quadratic in E, okay? So it's the determinant of, where here it's a co-triad. So it's the inverse of the determinant of the triad. Okay, so here what we get, we don't get any, the determinant is going to cancel out, which is nice, and we get something linear in the triad times this curvature tensor, which is now a function of omega, epsilon, where here we have to be a bit careful with what we're doing because it's a, so it's an antisymmetric so here I'm going to use this notation. I'm going to add this on the epsilon to just that you remember that this is a tensor density with weight 1. Okay, so this object when so here before we were talking about this one, but it's in the internal indices. Now when we are in the space-time indices, we have to be careful because this is a tensor density of weight 1, and so which means that it does not transform exactly as a tensor. So you know what is the tensor density. You've seen that. Okay. So if you don't know, the last tutorial, the optional question was about that. So and it's just what is changing is just that when we so what is a tensor? It's how do you define a tensor? Is the way it's transformed under coordinate transformation. Okay, the way. And here, when you do some coordinate transformation, you also add kind of the determinant of the metric coming out. Okay, so that's why you have really to be careful because if you want to change coordinate or lower indices, then you get some metric component coming out of that. Okay, so yeah, check if you're not really familiar with that. You can see last question of tutorial 2. Okay. Okay, and so this is, so I have a few things to say about this is going to be our action. Then, so here, of course, it's called E, but if you change notation and you call that B, then you get exactly what is a BF action, okay? So just the term of the name. So the BF action is a very general thing that can be, is valid in any dimension. So you can generalize this kind of action to any dimension and it will still be a topological theory, okay? So it's a class of topological theory. So here just what we call a BF action. And so the F is for the curvature, the B is for this field that and it's a topological theory in any dimension. So here it's written in 3D, but it can be generalized. And it's at some point I also mentioned to you that in 4D, the way we build usually spin foam model is starting from a topological theory and adding some constraint to recover the geometrical degrees of freedom. And the way we do that is starting from the BF action for 4D. We can really rewrite gravity as a BF action plus constraint. Okay. So this is first comment. Then the other thing is that now if you look at the equation of motion, contrary to maybe the metric form where you get this Einstein tensor here or that simplify here. Here you get exactly that directly that the curvature is vanishing. Okay, so this is one of your first equation of motion. So these are equation of motion. Here, if you want to again, we didn't impose. So this is the way we build it, is that we work with the antisymmetric connection, but we haven't imposed the torsion free, the torsion that it, the torsion is vanishing for it. And this appears as an equation of motion here. So now, okay, so what we want to do now is to do the canonical analysis. So maybe we can first start with this action and look at maybe the symmetry of this action. And yeah, so in fact, this action, so obviously is going to be invariant under rotation in the internal indices, and we're going to see that. It's invariant under diffeomorphism, as expected. But there is an additional symmetry that is maybe more surprising. But we're going to see that it's easy to check that indeed this action is invariant under this action. It's invariant under translation. And yeah, so let me write that down. And you can, as an exercise, you can check explicitly what does it mean that this is invariant under translation. And it's, again, what is going to make that 3D is also so simple. In addition to be topological, we have that we're going to see that on shell, the diffeosymmetry can really be written as a combination of the translation symmetry and the rotation symmetry. Yeah?
If we had not used the assumption that the spin connection was anti-symmetric, would we get a physically different theory?
So if it's not anti-symmetric, then the issue is, oops, sorry. I think we use it, let me just check, because it's the fact that it's asymmetric. I think we use it to determine this equation. So I'm not, yeah, we'll have to check. I'm wondering if we are not using it. No, because the compatibility condition can be written even if we don't impose it. It would be just that. Yeah, what I'm not totally sure is if we don't make this assumption, because here what we're trying to, so we start from the Riemann tensor, and the Riemann tensor is written in terms of the Levi-Civita connection. So as soon as we consider that this omega doesn't have all these conditions, it also means that the Levi-Civita connection is in fact not the Levi-Civita connection. And so I'm not sure what will be the Riemann tensor if we remove the metric compatibility for the Levi-Civita condition, because it's related to the antisymmetric of omega is related to the compatibility condition, metric compatibility condition of omega. So yeah, it's a good question, but I don't know here what are the implications. Yeah, but so yeah, it's maybe a good point to mention that indeed here, so first, why is it interesting to work with this new framework? So first, triads are variables that are really familiar in gauge theory. And so this is going to really allow us to export quantization techniques from more lattice gauge theory into general relativity, okay, being able to write with triad and so on. Then there are two other advantages to this formulation over the metric formulation. So first is that here now we're working with kind of disallow Cartan geometry instead of just Riemannian Riemann geometry. And it's a bit more general. So it also means that we can include some torsion in our theory. Okay, and that to have this freedom at the quantum level is also kind of interesting to be able to relax that. And the second one, and I think it's related to your question yesterday, is that in the metric formation, we don't know how to couple fermion to GR, but here we are able to couple fermions in this framework. And I indeed check that the name spin for the spin connection come from that indeed you can couple spinor to this connection. So your question was. Okay, so yeah, these are kind of the advantage we have working with these things. So first, it allows us to kind of export techniques from more lattice gauge theory, and then we have a more general geometry, and in case we want, we can also couple fermions to this theory. Okay, so now just for the symmetries, just going to do the list, and it's going to be, we're going to study that more in detail in the canonical framework, because we're going to get constrained and we will want to interpret this constraint as generating one of these symmetry. So we have the rotation in the internal index. Then we have the DFAO. And we have a translation symmetry. And you can check indeed that this action here in the green box is indeed invariant under the following transformation, parameterized just by a scalar field with just one internal index. So I'm considering the transformation characterized by this scalar field with one internal index. And you can look at, if you look at this transformation on your triad and on your connection. So since it's a translation, by definition, the translation is zero on the connection. And here, it's just a translation. So we are looking at a covector. Here it's a co-triad, so it's a covector for space-time indices. So we want to translate that with a covector. So here it's obtained by this thing. So now if you replace AG mu here in your action by this delta, AG mu, and you integrate by part, and you need to remember also the Bianchi identity that is the same that for the I guess Young-Mead theory, if you've seen that, then you get that indeed your action your action is invariant. Okay, so here you need to, so I don't know, you want me, so exercise. Check that the action is indeed invariant. And yeah. So I guess here we figure out you need to replace E by this small variation, do an integration by part, and then you will find the Bianchi identity here. Okay, so just one last also remark that I forget about the kind of equivalence between the two formulation, okay, the metric and the triad formulation. So these two formulation are really, in fact, equivalent if you, in addition, require that they lead to non-degenerate metric. And by non-degenerate metric, you want that the determinant of G is not zero. So you need to kind of add some constraint on the co-triad. But when we, so usually we don't do this restriction. And so we have a bit more solution here, OK? OK, so I have 20 minutes to do the canonical analysis. Any questions first? OK, so now it's really. Like this.
I'm sorry, I have a question. So that translation, you mean it is a space-time dependence translation, or a general coordinate transformation, or a rigid, maybe something like a rigid.
So it's just what I mean is that here, so this is a transformation on your co-triad. So by translation, it means that this, so what is this object for space? This object for space-time is like, it's a covector. So by translation, you mean that you add a covector to this object. Okay, but here it's parameterized by this scalar for the space-time indices and this index here. Okay, so the way you get a one form here, starting from the scalar and this index, this internal index is by acting with this covariant derivative. Okay, so it's really, yeah, it's a simple, what we mean by translation is just you add the same kind of object to your initial object that is constant.
But then J could have some space-time dependence.
Yeah, it's at each point. Okay, it's a gauge transformation. Okay, so now let's do the Hamiltonian analysis. And so the first step is to choose a slicing of your manifold. As I said, usually in gravity, we consider manifold where this slicing is always possible, where this is my 2D surface. And now we need to, so here we are talking about space-time indices. So we also need to consider some adapted coordinates for this slicing. So I'm going to use 0 for the time, and A now is going to denote the spatial part. And so this surface is at x0 or t is a constant. So it's a kind of equal time surface. And then starting from, so let me rewrite s maybe with nicer. So yeah, I'm going to get this one out of this because we need it later on and change the sign. So we're going to start from this action. And so here it's kind of not really nicely written, but a bit later in the course, we're going to introduce Lie algebra valued form, and then you can really rewrite things nicely. But let's start with all the indices right now, and then we will work with less indices when we will be more familiar with what are all these objects. Okay, so now what we want to do is kind of isolate the time derivative that we have here. So I can just rewrite that this is so the time derivative that I will have is going to be on my connection, okay? When nu is equal to 0, then I get the time derivative of my connection, and it's the only time derivative I can get, okay? I'm going also to do change of notation, sorry, just because otherwise I'm doing confused all the time, but it's also because it's closer to what you will find in the literature. So instead of now this omega, I'm going to use the A to denote the spin connection. So I hope it's not going to be too confusing. Okay, so here I want the time derivative. So you can check. Where this epsilon AB means that I forget about the 0, okay? So it's epsilon 0 AB or epsilon AB 0 if you want. And then you can only define it like this. So I'm just rewriting this line by doing this slicing and using this new adapted coordinates and putting away the derivative with respect to time, okay? So here, what do I get then? Sorry, I get. And then we can discuss about all these actions. So only here, it's only special part. I still have this epsilon AB going out. And then I have this term. LM EM. Also, again, this tensor AB. Okay, so hopefully I don't have too many indices, three indices about AB. Okay, should be fine. Okay, so what can we say now? Here, the canonical, we get one canonical pair, okay, of variable, which is going to be this connection and what we're going to call the densitized triad, and I'm going to give you what it is, and you should know how to get it. So sorry, it's a y, and then I have some delta j k delta a b, and then a delta on space x y. So what is this? Of course, this you obtain it as usual by looking at the variation of your action with respect to the derivative of your first derivative of your configuration variable. And you get that. So you just have to read what is in front of. So the derivative with respect to that. So you get this epsilon AB EJ P here. And this is what we call the densitized. Okay, so this is just by, again, extracting this term, the derivative of this term, and we get the, we can figure out what is the canonical pair. Then what are the interpretation of these variables here? There is no time derivative. They appear linearly. So here we can say that they are Lagrange multiplier. And we can read directly our constraints that are going to be given by this term and this term here. So all the other Poisson brackets, again, except this one, are all vanishing, all the other one. And then, so if you do the variation with respect to this variable now, you give the following constraint. So what are the constraints? Is so you see that as a constraint, you get the curvature. And the other one is going to be, so this is what you're going to call the flatness constraint. And here I introduce a G because it's going to be the Gauss constraint. And this one is related to the torsion. OK, so you see that in the canonical analysis, the equation of motion now appears as constraint. And let me maybe write explicitly what they are. So again, Fj is this epsilon AB. And then, so it, so here it's not written explicitly, but Bj plus 1 half JKL. AB. Okay, so this is what we call, and it's going to be the flatness constraint. And we're going to see that the flatness constraint is going to be the constraint generating the translation symmetry. This is what we need to understand now. And J here is the Gauss constraint. And it can be written in terms of this densitized triad, where now we get JML AL, and this is what we call the Gauss constraint. So these are the constraints of our theory, and we're going to see that indeed these constraints are first class and generate the symmetry, the gauge symmetry we have in the theory. Okay, so now what does it mean if you look at what would be the Hamiltonian? Okay, so if you interpret this as your PQ dot, then what you get here is your Hamiltonian, and you see that the Hamiltonian is a sum of constraints. And then I think it's, I don't know if it's related to me, because I think it was broken when I did the quantum theory course. Then it stayed broken for a while, but I was not teaching. Then it was working again, but I was not teaching. And now I've been teaching like a week, and in a week it's already the second time. So kind of hopefully. Okay. Bye. Okay, so let's use this one. At least the position is not so bad. I think you can still read what is written in the middle board. And also the one. So now just the Hamiltonian. And this is really a general characteristic of Diffeau invariant system, is that the Hamiltonian is a sum of the constraint. Okay? And H is indeed, where here I use, instead of, here we have Lagrange multiplier, so it can be any function. So I just put this parameter here, the Lagrange multiplier with. So here we indeed get a totally constrained system. Okay, so now we're going to go to the interpretation of the constraint. But before that, or maybe we won't go today. What do you think about the way I derive the canonical pairs? So the canonical pair, I think so. And the constraint, is it what you did in tutorials? Or? So if you look at this action, like, so the starting point is your action here. What are your variables? What would be your phase space initially? If I didn't give you the answer with, it's only this canonical pair that we have. When you look at the system of this particle on a circle, you also had a variable that was appearing linearly in your action, and for which you didn't have any time derivative. It was this Q3. And in the Lagrangian formalism, you indeed interpreted that as a Lagrange multiplier. But in the canonical framework, we didn't interpret that directly as a Lagrange multiplier. You had to go through all this procedure. And in fact, the constraint in front of this, what you would have called the Lagrange multiplier, appear only at the secondary constraint. Okay, so here, indeed, we didn't really do the full Hamiltonian analysis. In fact, when I'm giving you this canonical pair, it's already kind of a reduced phase space, if you want, because if you would be started from really the beginning, you would consider that all the components of your triad, or the co-triad here, would be in your phase space. And then all the components of your connection will be in your phase space. And then what you would do is try to find all the associated conjugated momenta of all these variables. And of course, you will find that many of them are zero. So we call this equation primary constraint. Okay. And indeed, you can do that. You can do this analysis and go to the primary constraint. And then these two constraints that are the flatness and the Gauss constraint, as in the case of this particle moving on a circle, would appear only as secondary constraint. Okay? But the point is that all these constraints won't be first class. There would be some second class constraints. So we can solve them kind of explicitly and then end up only with first class constraints. And it's indeed what happened here. Okay, so it's in most of the literature. So there is, I posted one article on the wiki page where they really do the complete analysis. I can give the title if I have it here. So it's already on the wiki page. Yeah, it's by Romanos. And if you want to see really the complete Romanos article, which is, it's on the wiki page. So maybe it's not very clear. And then here they really do the usual canonical analysis. And to recover this phase space, in fact, you need to kind of do a gauge fixing. And you end up here with only first class constraint and this framework. But in most of the paper, then it's directly presented like this. Okay. So of course, normally what you need to do is to do the complete analysis and really check that you can get here and you're not forgetting any degrees of freedom. Here we could do the counting of degrees of freedom to check that we're indeed correct. How many variables do we have? So I can try. So here it's 3 indices times 2. Okay, so it's 6. And 2 times 3, it's also 6. So we get 12. Okay, kind of 4. And it's at each point. So in fact, it's times infinity. But let's forget about the infinity right now. let's just see, kept the 12 here. And here also at each point, we have 3 plus 3. So it's 6. But they're all first class constraints. We're going to look at the We haven't checked the constraint algebra yet, but when we're going to compute the Poisson bracket of this constraint, we're going to see that they are indeed first class. So 6 times 2, it's 12. So 12 minus 12 is 0, as expected, because we're in 3D. Okay, so that's fine. There is no, we're safe. Well, first, we're safe once we will have checked that indeed they are first class. But anyway, it's interesting to check what is the constraint algebra. It also give give an interpretation of this constraint. Okay, so I think I'm not going to try to do more. On Monday, then now that we did the canonical analysis, we're going to look at the interpretation of this constraint and start quantizing the theory. Okay, so introduce what are the basic variables. So we'll go through all the steps of the Dirac program, and already finding the right basic variables is going to take some time, and we need to justify. Okay.